The following program was pre-recorded on WFAN. It's time for Hello, My Name is Craig, our weekly candid conversation about gambling addiction. It's supported by the Council on Compulsive Gambling of New Jersey, 800-GAMBLER. Now, here's Craig Carton.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of Hello, My Name is Craig. Craig Carton with you for the next 30 minutes. A frank, open, honest conversation about gambling addiction and the addicts that fall prey to it, like myself. And my co-host, as always, Dan Trillaro. Danny, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing great, Craig. Good morning.
Joining us from New Jersey is Lorenzo. And Lorenzo, like myself and Dan, is a gambler in recovery. Lorenzo, good morning, and thank you so much for stopping by today.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
Doing good. When was your last wager, if you don't mind me asking?
A little over 6 years ago.
Congratulations. That's awesome.
Great.
Thank you.
Let's tell part of your story, at least here in the time we have. When did you start gambling? And before it ever became a problem, as you kind of look back on your life with the clarity you now have, when do you remember your first kind of introduction to gambling?
Very, very first introduction would have been like, pitching quarters. As a kid,
right?
Like that far back. I was addicted to everything and anything way before I even understood what any of that even meant.
Gotcha. So you, so gambling was not your only vice, yeah?
No, definitely not.
I gotcha.
One of many.
I hear you. It's funny. A buddy of mine, A buddy of mine had an older brother. And his brother, kind of like us, got into everything and anything he could. And his dad sat him down one day and said, "Listen, it's okay to have one vice, but you can't have all the vices. So,
yeah.
So pick one." That kind of conversation. When did you, as you look back, when did you start gambling, at least on a regular basis? Again, even before it became problematic, were you a young guy or were you a little bit older when that started?
I would say probably like mid to late 20s when
okay.
It really started becoming a regular event.
And was that casino gambling? Was it sports gambling? A combination? What was your kind of choice at the beginning?
Yeah, I mean, it really for me it was poker.
Got it.
And then turned into some sports betting, but mainly was poker.
And was that a Chris Moneymaker thing, or was you were playing poker long before Hold'em became so popular?
Funny enough, as you get deeper into recovery, you get a chance to get back on some stuff. On my honeymoon, I spent a big portion of my honeymoon, because that was the year that Moneymaker went.
Right.
On a big portion of my honeymoon, I spent late night while my wife would be asleep or whatever, watching the main event. So definitely played a part.
And as a guy who liked to play cards, you've said to yourself, "Oh, that's not that difficult. I know how to play poker. I could do that too," right?
The thought was, if this guy could do it, why can't I?
Yeah, and by the way, and Dan, I'll bring you here on this. I bring up Chris Moneymaker when we talk about guys that played poker as their game of choice, because it was a watershed moment in this country for poker, for online poker, and for every guy out there, me, you, Lorenzo, who thought he was good at cards, was the best guy in his Friday night game at home, who now said, "Wait a minute, I could put 10 grand together and go to Vegas, and I'm going to win a couple million."
Yeah, it was that, oh my gosh, here's a normal average guy, that's me, sitting at home, and I can do the same thing. And when you glamorize it, and you see nothing but the positives, we don't know what led up to that, we don't know how much money he had lost previous to that, but here's this on national TV, main show, oh my gosh, I can do this too. And now I'm going to try and kind of chase that feeling. I want to be famous. I want to be that person that everyone sees. If he can do it, I can do it. No doubt.
So did you start playing a lot of online poker though, or no?
No, a lot of it was underground games,
right.
Backyard games, stuff like that, which, also helped feed other addictions. And, they were all like intertwined. It was a very insane way to live.
For sure.
Just being one of them.
Yeah, people don't understand the underground games, and I played in a lot of them. It's one of those. It's a hard thing to explain. Like, a lot of people watch the movie Rounders and think they understand, what the underground card game scene is like. And, Teddy KGB ain't at those games. At least the ones I played in. There are people like him. But it's one of those things where there's an assumption when you go to those games that you want to do everything and everything is provided for you because you're willing to go there and lose your money. And I experienced the same exact thing, Lorenzo. And I look back on it now, and I'm like, man, you're so much smarter than that. Like, you had to know that wasn't smart. Like, I'm in Koreatown, and I'm not going to say exactly where, of course, because they did nothing wrong. I did. And it's, you know, I got a radio show to do at 6 o'clock in the morning, and at 3:30, I'm given a secret password to be buzzed into an apartment that doesn't exist to go play cards with guys, and I'm not the only guy there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And not only that, but it also it's like it is a great, and I'm being sarcastic by saying it, but it's a great environment to do anything that you want in a negative way. You will find someone there that will help nurture that way of living. Like, it doesn't matter what it is.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. I've told people now that I'm in recovery, you know, over 4 years, that there are people that are no longer in my life because they can't, because it's not healthy for me. Same with you guys, where they did nothing wrong. And even knowing my story, knowing how I got in trouble, knowing all that stuff that's involved with it, there's no joke. If I picked up the phone right now and said, I want to do A, B, and C, whatever those bad things are, they'd be in my house in 20 minutes to pick me up.
Oh, absolutely.
Yep. 100%. So how did it become problematic for you? Were you started playing too much, it overtook your life, you're wagering too much. How did it go from, hey, I like playing poker, I'm pretty good at it, to now it's a problem?
I mean, again, because it was always like connected to other addictions as well, I was okay with whatever consequences came about at the time, whether it be a little skid bid, a little state bid, doing some county time. Whatever came along with the life I was living, I was okay with.
Right.
And then the problem was, as a friend of mine just said one day, the consequences just got too great, but I couldn't stop. So
right. So you processed, hey, I can do a month in county, a week in county,
sure.
But as that progresses, the amount of time progresses, the level of type place you're at progresses, and then you get into a position where you're not going to be well.
Correct. Correct. So it was a really crazy way to think. And, you know, early on, you know, as a kid, you know, you get sentenced to a couple of years in state prison. You're like, all right, you go, you almost wear it as a badge of honor. It's again, insane way of thinking and living. But you go, you do it, you come back, then you get a little older, have some, you know, you get married, have some kids, you know, try to like live somewhat of a normal life.
Right.
But still feed your addictions. Eventually, you know, time will catch up and If it's not prison and insanity, it'll be death. And for me, it was all three. I was brought back from death, but it was all three. So
wow, so
there was nowhere to go.
That's it. That's interesting. So your health took a hit too, obviously.
Sure.
And what's if you don't mind me asking, and by all means, if you don't want to share, I respect that. You know, you acknowledge that. You know, you went away for a bit, but what happened where you almost lost your life?
I mean, I overdosed.
Got it.
So. Yeah, you know.
Got it. That's scary. What did your marriage survive all this or no?
You know, oddly enough, like at the very end when it really came to an end, my wife was gone in her own way. My kids were taken by DIFUS, CTS. Everything was gone. And it gave me like having the deck cleared actually gave me the ability to just focus on what I needed to do for me for the moment. And it was the best thing ever because of those first, like that first year, in the county with recovery around recovering addicts, trying to just support me becoming better, within a very realistically short period of time. And this is just my story. This doesn't happen for everybody.
Sure.
You know, I got my kids back. All four of my kids are back with me, full custody. Me and my wife worked on our marriage. We're at a better place now than we've ever been. And, you know, slowly we're able to rebuild. But realistically, you know, as I said in the beginning of the show, I've just recently celebrated 6 years. The miracles just keep on popping in.
That's so awesome to hear that. You know, and listen, not to blow smoke up your ass because I know you don't want that or need that. but none of that happens without you being willing to put in the work and also kind of drop the ego a little bit and recognize, you know what, I'm not that cool, I'm not that guy, I'm making bad decisions, it's negatively impacting other people, and I'm going to own it. And that took me forever to get to that place too. But once you own it, and you really own it, you don't just pay lip service to it, you're right. Like, everything can, doesn't always work out this way, Dan, right? But everything can get better. You know, you lose relationships, and I don't want to minimize that, because you do lose important relationships, financial issues, marital issues, kid issues, living issues. But once you are willing to be honest about, I've got a problem, and it's my problem, things can get better, literally, starting the next day.
They do. And it comes down to that checking that ego at the door. And I think that's the common characteristic that we all have, is that in the midst of that gambling, you know, you mentioned before, Lorenzo, like going to prison at a season of your life, it was like a badge of honor. And I can relate to that, because there was a part of that where it was so crappy to be there, and you'd be around guys listening to what they talk and how they describe being in prison. The thing that really amazed me was how they talked about time passing. You know, you get guys with a 5-year sentence and they're like, oh, it's just a little 5 years. I think now when I'm just going about everyday life, 5 years is a long time to be missing life, right? And living it there. So it goes back to ego. It goes back to perception. It goes back to experience. But life can get better when we just drop all that stuff at the door and say, I surrender. I'm done. I'm getting the crap kicked out of me every day by this addiction. I need to do something different. I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired.
We're going to take a quick break. Continue on with Lorenzo and Dan right after this on Hello, My Name is Craig.
Back to more of Hello, My Name is Craig on The Fan with your host, Craig Carton, and supported by the Council on Compulsive Gambling of New Jersey, 800-GAMBLER.
Welcome back to Hello, My Name is Craig. Dan Trillaro and Lorenzo, who's sharing a story with us. Lorenzo, like myself and Dan, is a gambler in recovery. Lorenzo, let me just ask, what was the bottom of the barrel moment for you that made you eventually decide to go get the help that you've gotten? And I wonder if you could share that story with us.
Sure. Well, I was arrested, also known as being rescued. And I just remember laying on the grass on my front lawn, and at the time, my 12-year-old daughter was sitting on the front steps watching this chaos ensue with, you know, multiple agencies, cops, everyone's all around, you know, screaming, yelling, going through the house. And I just remember she was like a deer in the headlights, and I was just looking at her the whole time, and I'm trying to tell her it's going to be okay. And again, still in that moment, knowing it's not going to be okay, but still trying to play the part like I had it all under control. Like, this was all part of a master plan.
Right.
And it's funny because, you know, it wasn't until I really early on, after I maybe 10, 11 months in recovery, I remember going to a meeting. I was so angry. I was such an angry person. I was always screaming and yelling, and the system sucked and everyone sucked. And, you know, it was just, you know, poor me, right? It wasn't me. It was the world. It wasn't me. And I just remember lashing out at a meeting, talking about my kids being in DIFAS custody and how horrible DIFAS was, and they weren't letting me see my kids. And I was going to hire the best lawyer and da-da-da-da-da. And a person came up to me after the meeting. He said, hey, man, he's like, I appreciate your share and et cetera. And he said, last week you were talking about living on your mom's couch, right? And I said, yeah. And he goes, well, where are you getting the money for this high-priced lawyer that's going to fight DIFAS? And those little reality checks.
Yeah, he called you on your book rap.
Absolutely. Those little reality checks as they were happening. And then another woman who had been through the DIFAS situation said to me, here's an odd idea. He's like, stop fighting him. How about you just call him up tomorrow and go, hey, listen, you know what? Whatever you want to do, I'll do it and see if that works.
Right.
And magically, you know, as I follow suggestions from people who had been there and done that, the experience of others gave me the ability to stop trying to fix, manage, and control every situation in my life. Get honest, say, look, I got no idea what I'm doing. I need help. Will somebody help me? And life just really, just little by little, I started seeing the little fruits of recovery. And, you know, things have really, you know, taken a turn. And I went back to school. My wife went back to school. My kids are all great. I got kids in college now. You know, life is good.
No, it sounds amazing. I got chills listening to you talk because, you know, these are the stories people need to hear because you've seen both sides of it. You've been at the lowest of lows. You know, being incarcerated ain't fun. It's not a picnic. It's a dangerous, dangerous place with, you know, a lot of bad people. There are some good people in there, too, for sure. People that you meet. I've told this story before, Lorenzo, where, you know, I was only away for a year. But I met people in there that changed my life for the better from the standpoint that, you know, on a piece of paper, if you read what they were convicted of or what they allegedly did, I wouldn't let them within 1,000 miles of my family, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet I found, not all of them, because I was away with some bad people too, people who I literally wouldn't let within 1,000 miles of my family. But I also met other guys who were the most loyal, honest, giving, righteous people that I've ever met in my entire life. And once again, you know, when you wake up at 6 a.m. to a bed check, or go, you know, 3 times a day, they're checking you. And you're just another guy, you know, wearing tans. You know, you kind of lose sight of a lot of things. And these are some of the guys that got me straight. You know, guys who've done serious bids in their lifetime, not just, you know, a year in a federal place or the amount of time you may have done, or Danny, what you did, who every day of my stay there reinforced, you know, you don't belong here. You shouldn't be here. Get your crap together and start figuring it out and stop blaming everybody else. You're here because of you.
Yep.
And I think because I respected them and their backgrounds, guys much tougher than me, guys from different backgrounds than me, I think that's ultimately what allowed me to really pay homage to, I need help, I messed up, it's on me, and get to a place that I'm at today. And I don't know, like you said something, Lorenzo, that when you got arrested, that was like your salvation, looking back on it. You know, in the time when you get arrested in the time, it's the worst thing that could ever happen to your entire life, especially with your kids watching it go down or being aware of it. But looking back on it, it saved your life.
Oh, absolutely, 100%. And it is. I credit, like, those first people, those beginning people. It's funny, you know, I still live in the town where it all happened. I mean, it's not like I went too far.
Right.
And, you know, the cops here all know the background story. And now, you know, instead of, like, ducking and dodging when I'm around them, I, you know, we wave, we say hello, we speak. You know, they coach my kids in sports and, you know, that whole gamut. And it was people early on. I was fortunate enough, lucky enough. I got into a program at the county facility that I was at that was dedicated for addiction. That's the whole program was centered around addiction at the county level. And I wasn't even supposed to be in that program. My status, I had a high status, would not allow me, needed a minimum status because of my charges and my background. So it didn't allow me into the program. And it was a captain at the time. I basically just broke down in front of him. I said, listen, man, my life is garbage. I need to do something.
Right.
And he like took pity on me. You know, gave me an override, which is removed my status and gave me a lower status so that way I can go into the program.
Hmm.
And I credit the captain who took pity on me and the officer who was in charge of the program, staff that was there, previous inmates, previous people who had background in addiction coming in and bringing in meetings every single night. Every single night they brought a recovery meeting, you know, that wasn't part of like the curriculum there. It wasn't like the recovery side,
right,
side of it. This was like 12-step programs coming in every single night, you know, bringing in the message of recovery and meeting people that had done 15 years. And I'm like, yeah, that's all crap. And he's like, well, I've been 15 years and I'm able to put my life together. And I'm like, what?
Right.
Slowly believing those stories. And it was those same people that I then hooked up with when I came home because I didn't know what to do. I did know that everyone consistently would tell me, when you get out, make a meeting. So that was the same kind of repetitive,
sure,
information that I got. And I'm sure anybody who's been in recovery understands what that means is, you know, because you don't know what else to do. So you make a meeting and you connect with people. And that's what I did. I hit they finally, after 11 months, let me go on a bracelet once they figured out what they wanted to do with my case. you know, was released, and then just started making meetings. And
I think it's great. Your story is powerful and moving, and, yeah. and I'm proud of you because I know the exact steps you took to get to where you're at. I lived it, as Dan did too. I wonder if you could do me a solid here. There's a lot of people listening right now who might be at, you know, day one. They might still be dealing with, you know, addiction, whether it's drugs, alcohol, and, of course, for our purposes, gambling, who recognize they have a problem, but, you know, they don't know how to handle it. They don't know where to go, what to do. You know, it's daunting for them. It's overwhelming for them. The walls are caving in. And I think hearing people like you talk about, you know, being at the bottom of the barrel, being incarcerated, all the things you went through, and now living an amazing life worth living and having your family by your side, what would you say to those people who are at step one of this journey to give them some hope that they can get there too?
It's funny because I hang on and it gets greater later. I mean, that's just the reality of it. I didn't know why I kept coming. For real, it was just, for me, it was blind faith. I did not see, and I'm not saying faith in a religious way. I'm saying just faith that the people that were around weren't lying. I could meet complete strangers. You know, as a street guy, an addict of all sorts, you know, having a judge or a lawyer or caseworker or any PhD, anybody with initials after their name, telling me that I could do it wasn't as powerful as complete strangers telling me that I could do it, who really didn't want anything out of me other than just seeing me do well.
Right.
And, you know, walking into rooms and it's not easy. Listen, you know, I might be comfortable now. I can walk into rooms all across America now and feel comfortable. That is an awkward feeling, you know, to walk into a place and, you know, just sit there. You don't have to raise your hand. Like if you are a newcomer, you don't have to raise your hand. You don't have to speak. You could just listen. Even that was very tough for me to do. Just sit there and listen to people. Basically tell their story or give a therapy on up a specific subject. It didn't feel right. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, especially for me, you know, man's man, right? Yep. Like you're not supposed to have feelings. You're not supposed to have emotions. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to be a tough guy. You did prison, that all like this, the crap that, you know, I believed what it was to be a man, all needed to change. But it doesn't happen overnight. And keep coming is the saying, because you're not going to get it in one day. You're not going to get that perspective or that feeling that things are going to get better or that comfortability overnight. You have to keep showing up. And eventually, you know, it happens. That's why they say don't leave until the miracle happens. That's the miracle.
I appreciate you coming on and sharing the story. If I can ever return the favor, please ask me to, because I'd love to. And keep doing what you're doing, because you're doing a great job. Your kids should be proud of you. I'm sure they are. I'm sure your wife's proud of you as well. And I hope that we can meet in person one day and shake hands. But I really appreciate you sharing your story, and I think it makes a difference for people out there that might be going down that road. So thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, bud.
Hey, before we get out of here, Dan, I just want to give you a chance to comment on Lorenzo's story and the journey as he described it. You know, it's powerful, it's moving, and if nothing else, I think his story gives everybody out there hope that, hey, if he could do it, I could do it.
Yeah, it's a reminder that, you know, people who struggle with addiction are not always, you know, bad people. We make bad choices, bad decisions. We're struggling with this powerful thing that just, if you're not addicted, you just don't quite understand it. You know, the commonality, even when I was at a campus in Central Arkansas, one of the student athletes afterwards said, well, why didn't you ever just stop? Like, why is it so difficult to stop? It's not like you're putting drugs in your body. And we talked like 15 minutes after that, because gambling is a drug. You don't put it in the same way that you do with substance, but it's a drug that enters your body. It impacts your mind. It's a behavioral disorder, right? It's a non-substance addiction. And so for people who haven't lived that life, they'll never really fully understand it. And to hear Lorenzo's story of, you know, returning back and spending his time in prison, and now, you know, for the last 6 years, life gets better. And I love what he said, you know, just hang on, you know, it gets better as time goes on. And it's so true. And it's a reminder that we just constantly have to continue to check our egos at the door.
Yeah.
Because as soon as that keeps, if the ego bubbles up, that's when we start to run the risk of return to use.
To me, that's the key thing. Everyone's got to know it. We can all pay lip service to it, but I don't think you can get the help, but I don't think you can overcome gambling addiction until you take ownership that you're the problem. And until you're willing to do that for real. Not to, like I said, not just say it in a meeting or tell it to family members or loved ones. You have to live it. It's got to be in your soul. And one, I'm telling you, the day you do that, everything starts getting better. But it starts with honesty.
Better. And, you know, somebody once said to me a very funny thing. They said, your butt has to get smaller in recovery. And I said, what do you mean? And they said, your B-U-T, not your B-U-T-T, your butt. Less use of the word butt, because when you enter recovery early on, a lot of people will say, well, I did this, but, right? And that's kind of that hedge to say, you know, it really wasn't my fault. There's nothing I can do about it. So you've got to get that butt a little bit smaller as recovery goes on, because then you just take that ownership and say, listen, I'm a flawed human being. I need support, and I'm looking for help and guidance.
Well, Dan, as always, appreciate your time. That's Dan Treloar. We'll do it again next week, okay, pal?
Sounds great, man. Have a great week.
Have a great weekend, and thank you for listening to Hello, My Name is Craig.